Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour following the latest news, Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis talk with Matt Grossman, who leads MSU's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research.
Well, our mission is to inform public policy and improve governance in Michigan, and we get to cover the issue spectrum and be a part of state politics and policymaking and try to connect the university with what's happening down the road at the state capitol.
Then Simon and Hollis talk Spartan volleyball.
The physicality in this league is ridiculously high. We play more like men, and the size in the Big Ten is there. So you're seeing the speed of the ball. It's traveling at a much higher pace.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. This is MSU Today on 870 AM WKAR. Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Matt Grossman. Matt leads Michigan State University's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research.
It's really a pleasure to welcome Matt Grossman, the director of MSU's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, dubbed IPSR. And so tell our audience what IPSR does and why you're excited to be its director.
Well, our mission is to inform public policy and improve governance in Michigan. And we get to see people throughout their political life cycle, from the time they're interning in the state legislature to the time they're running for office and elected. We get to cover the issue spectrum and be a part of state politics and policymaking and try to connect the university with what's happening down the road at the state capitol.
So one of the hallmarks of this preparation of future leaders is MPLP, the Michigan Political Leadership Program. I think it now has about 11 graduates that are in the legislature. What would make the graduates of that program sort of different from people who don't go through the program? Give a sense of that.
Well, we have some new research that says they're twice as likely to run for office and three times as likely to win elected office. So part of it is just giving people the tools they need to get in positions of responsibility. But then once they get there, we hope that they're able to work across the aisle better. They've had experiences with people in the other party. They tend to keep those friendship networks going, and to understand a little bit better where the other political party is coming from once they get in the legislature or in local government.
We should probably comment that MPLP is an old program, and it is supported by both Democrats and Republicans, who both feel, both parties and their representatives feeling that this is really important to enhance good governance. Mm-hmm. And that it is sort of fundraised in a variety of events, mostly a dinner in Detroit, a breakfast in Grand Rapids, so that there's really a buy-in by local communities for people who are part of this program. But you're sort of relatively new to your role, so you may want to talk about the program from your perspective. I've been around enough that I was at the first dinner, so.
Well, great. Yes, it's been going for quite some time now, since the early 1990s. I was able to step into an already successful program that has a very large and successful alumni base. So that was nice. I got to meet the new class of students. So I know that it continues to attract a future political talent, and it's fun to be a part of training them before they get into the rough and tumble of politics.
For me, the remarkable thing is, you think about the fundraising that goes with this program, that the partnership among the university, the leadership on the Democratic side, the leadership on the Republican side, has sustained itself for all these years through different power shifts. Mm-hmm. Different changes in might be core party ideology, but this program has remained something that they felt they needed to support in the spirit of good governance and good listening and active and respectful debate, I would say. So there's a tribute to IPSR for being able to create that kind of environment.
Absolutely. But, and the same is true of our legislative leadership program, which has been going since 1994. We just saw the new class of newly elected legislators, and we're expanding now to target new legislative staff as well. And in all those programs, we get broad support from the legislative leadership on both sides.
Yeah, this sense of bipartisanism that's so lacking in our public press.
Right.
So hopefully that this program can at least underscore that universities can be very much a part of that over a sustained period of time.
When you look at continuity in the governance process in the state of Michigan, and my dad was a lobbyist back in the day, I think when legislators were around for a longer period of time, maybe set in their ways, both with knowledge and the way that they process the government. Today, with term limits, with some other changes, is that a role that you would play in that educational process and communicating and developing strategies?
Well, absolutely. So the legislative leadership program was explicitly designed in the wake of term limits. MPLP continues to get support in part because people know that we'll have to regularly refresh the legislature with new people who kind of bring less experience to the office. And we think that also makes the sort of institutional staff of the legislature more important. So we try to integrate the Legislative Service Bureau, the also national actors like the National Conference of State Legislatures and the Council of State Governments that we bring in to speak to the legislative staff and the new legislators. And I think all of that can, and of course the resources of the university as well, and our researchers, all of that can kind of give a little bit more institutional knowledge and continuity, even if the legislatures switch over.
Beyond the borders of Michigan State, where would you collaborate in this process within the state of Michigan? Are there other universities? Are there other organizations that you're collaborating with in this process?
Yes. So, well, MPLP, first of all, is a weekend program that goes all around the state, so they don't stay around here. We have collaborators for all of our projects. Mm-hmm. We just started a new survey panel of people who work in and around state government, and we're doing that in cooperation with U of M. We regularly involve people from other universities and around the state.
Now, Matt, you're a scholar yourself, but Charlie Ballard, who coordinates the State of the State survey, gets a lot more airtime regarding his views than you might as a director. Tell people a little bit about the State of the State survey and what that means for information for the people of Michigan.
Yeah, so we have a regular ongoing survey that's on its 74th round, which gives people regular information about the state of politics and the economy in Michigan. And Charlie Ballard has really become associated with that as a spokesperson for trends in Michigan's economy and political views. I got to add some information in the latest election and some more political side of it. But we're happy to have the ongoing economic information as well.
You gave one of your new books to Mark and me, so we'll have a chance to learn a bit more from an academic perspective. It's called Asymmetric Politics. You want to?
Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so our view is that the two political parties are very different. The Republican Party is sort of united around broad principles and views about the size and scope of government, about the role of America in the world. And the Democratic Party is really a coalition of disparate social groups, each of which have a different policy concern. And we think that they operate quite differently, both in campaigns and government, and we sort of treat them as mirror images too often. But we also say that each party has a potential majority in the American public, and it's because we have a sort of a divided political mind. We agree with the Republicans in principle, but the Democrats often in practice. So public opinion kind of shares conservative, broad conservative views about government, but when it comes to policy specifics, often is more favorable toward the policy plans of the Democratic Party. And that means that both can win. It also means that there's a potential for backlash against both political parties.
But doesn't it also suggest that for those who might see themselves as, let's say, fiscally conservative, even wanting to invest in America in different ways, but might see themselves as a bit more socially liberal, it presents kind of a conflict, because you have sometimes you just talk past one another on these issues that may unite more of us than not.
Yeah, so we say that each party kind of misunderstands the other by thinking that it's like themselves. So the Republicans view themselves as advancing the cause of limited government, and so they believe that the Democratic Party is sort of out to expand government for its own sake, move America in a socialist direction. The Democrats see themselves as representing disadvantaged social groups, and so they think that the Republicans are out there reinforcing privilege for its own sake. And we don't think either of those conceptualizations is right. We think both of the parties are different and that they need to understand each other better in order to communicate.
So what are some of the next projects you see on the horizon?
Well, we're very excited at IPSR about getting started with our legislative staff training to sort of fill in from our we're now doing two panels per semester with the legislative interns. We're going to be doing several with the legislative staff, and then we want to expand the legislative leadership program as well. We also have some new research projects. We have an ongoing big data compilation where we're collecting lots of information about policy differences across all 50 states over time. It's called the Correlates of State Policy, and it's available online for others to use, and we're using it to try to figure out what the big trends are in state policymaking and sort of what the consequences are of the Republican gains in state legislative elections around the country.
In terms of policy.
Yes.
So if you were to provide advice based on the research, I'm going to push you out here a little bit, about how we might be more aligned in terms of overall goals and potentially the capacity to find solutions that are more widely supported, because I think we all want a better America, a better Michigan, a better world, but are there some lessons from this research that are what you tell MPLP people that help us down that path without deciding what the answers will be? Because people often accuse academics of wanting to prescribe an answer.
Right. Well, on my research side, I would say that the two parties do compromise. We tend to do it in a specific fashion. We tend to pursue Democratic goals through Republican means. So we try to address the concerns of Democratic constituencies, but we tend to do it through decentralization to state and local governments, through using the private sector, through contractors and regulated markets. And we tend to do it through the tax code rather than through the direct appropriations. And so all of that results in a policy system that's pretty complicated rather than sort of just establishing a new bureaucracy to solve a particular goal. We tend to set up these regulated markets. You can see in Obamacare the kind of complicated system that we get. So we think that's a consequence of the two parties kind of pursuing divergent goals in government. But they should sort of realize that it sometimes creates a pretty complex pie. On the actual sort of intervention of IPSR in the policy process, I think our main idea is just that if we can get a more professionalized staff, if we can get an infrastructure of people who know the policy history, know the policy differences, then they'll be able to create better policy. So on the downside, we have term limits, but on the upside, we have professionalized bill writing. We have some institutional staff that's been there for a long time, and so we want to take advantage of that. And the research shows that if you can get that kind of training, then you have you get policy that's less likely to be overturned by the courts, that's more likely to win awards, for example. And so we think there is hope, and some of it comes from just learning the basic information and applying it.
I think it really comes down to how do you establish a common goal, and then the compromise really becomes much easier on the other issues. But the broadness of the nation or the broadness of the state make that a challenge sometimes because of the diversity in the interest that are out there. So it's a daunting task. There's no doubt about that, and it's incredible work that you're doing and very educational.
And we don't think the right answer is to sort of paper over our differences,
right,
or to pretend that there aren't big policy disputes that are based on people coming in from different principles. We think it's better to just work through what are those principles, what are those policy goals, and is there a way to bridge those differences.
How much time do you spend on the history part of governance, of going back in time and looking at how our nation was built, what the strength was, I guess, during our infancy, and how that correlates with what we're doing today?
Well, I don't go quite as far back to the foundings,
so.
But my last book before this one was on American policy change since 1945.
Okay.
And the big lesson from that was that it often takes individuals that have been in politics for a long time,
right,
and are motivated to compromise with other long-running policymakers in order to get policy done. So you often see these serial policymakers that were in it for a long time across issues. Issue areas and are successful because they're willing to work with anybody else who shares their goal of the moment and work hard on policy over an extended period.
How does that get through in a soundbite world of today? Because these are conversations that are simple in one level, but require patience and relationship building in another. And how do you think about that as we communicate in ever shorter time cycles? That's been happening for a long time. Everybody believes that the pace of acceleration of communication is going to just continue to accelerate. So it's not about any one person or their habits of communication. It's just that we're in an era where that speed is much more valued over a paragraph.
Well, absolutely, it's a challenge, and there's some sort of sad history about political information, which is that the time when we were most informed about politics as a nation was in the 1970s, when there were only three channels and everybody had to watch the news because that's all that was on. And sort of once people had other choices, they chose sports and entertainment or kind of went on their way. That doesn't mean that there aren't...
Their internet browser made the decisions for them.
Exactly. So that's not to say there aren't opportunities. People are enrolling in education for longer. Some people are interested in reading long-form articles as well. But we tend to be dividing now between kind of a hyper-informed and more partisan elite and a lot of folks that don't pay attention until the last few months of the election.
One of my... friends who thinks about the computer part of this, because they're really ubiquitous in whatever age group we are right now, said that one of the requirements of certain websites should be that if you look at website X for this piece of news, instead of the search engine sending you to three more that have the same views, it should flip you over and you should have to at least have one contrary view, whatever that is, to read, and then you can go back to your preferences about from whom you get your news. But you have to every once in a while listen to somebody that you don't agree with. And
yeah,
that
so
really has been the essence, I think, of MPLP, the leadership program, all those things, is that capacity to listen to people you don't agree with.
Yeah, there is some interesting data from social media which suggests that people do occasionally hear contrary views if they're following any kind of political news. The challenge is that even when you do hear contrary information, people are coming at it from their own perspective. They're counter-arguing the information. And so even kind of hearing the alternative doesn't necessarily make you open to it. So I really think it takes these kind of opportunities where you get to know someone, you develop a personal tie, and then you see where they're coming from in order to sort of really see the merits of the other side.
It's sort of the modern day equivalent of having no term limits on communication, right?
Yes. Now, we in the book, we actually tell an interesting story about the two parties' differences in information. That basically, in both media and university research, there was a correct perception on the Republican side that reporters and academics were disproportionately liberals and Democrats. And as a result, they sort of built these ideological alternatives in the media. We see with Fox News and talk radio. In universities, it was really sort of the think tank world where elites were drawing information more directly from those sources. And so, as I'm sure you experienced, we kind of face this challenge every day of both being an independent provider of information, but also now being seen by one side as sort of favoring a broad ideological perspective.
Well, Matt, we thank you for joining us. This is very topical, I think, right now, not only in our state, but across the country, and very informative. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being a part of Michigan State.
Thanks,
thank
Matt.
You.
That was Matt Grossman, director of Michigan State University's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, talking with Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon. To hear the conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. Up next, President Simon and AD Hollis talk Spartan volleyball. Broadcasting from the campus of Michigan State University, this is AM 870 WKAR. Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Spartans volleyball coach Kathy George and student athlete from the team, Alyssa Garverling.
It's great to have joining us from Spartan Volleyball, Kathy George and Alyssa Garverling. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you for having me here.
Let's jump right into it.
Okay.
Great season. I think we're looking forward to one next year that that will be right there. Talk a little bit about this past year.
Well, this past year we had a lot of juniors and seniors in our program, which were freshmen and sophomores at one time. And so, as you know, we like it when they get a little older, and some of the lessons they've learned over time really serve them well as we go through a very rigorous Big Ten. The Big Ten season this year had the number 1, 2, and 3 team in the nation. So no matter how do you slice it, you're going to play some good teams week in and week out. But with our team, we had, like I said, some older players. Alyssa Garverling, who's with us here, second team All-American. Autumn Bailey, honorable mention All-American. And a cast around it that's really, really talented. So we had 4 seniors. In that 4 seniors, though, Alyssa Fitterer and Chloe Reinig were the 2 that were pretty much, you know, the firepower for us, in addition to the others that we return next year. We return a great cast. I'm really excited about what we're doing, but, you know, we lost 8 or 9 times, and we weren't outclassed by anybody. We just really need to pick it up a little bit more and close that gap so that we can put ourselves in a position to do more than we did this year.
So, Alyssa, does she talk this much in practice?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She just,
it's nice.
It's like one question and you're done.
I know.
You like it when you can catch some air.
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
When you talk about the success of Big Ten volleyball, as you go through almost the whole list of teams, you're talking about national contenders. Is that something, as an aspiring, as a high school student-athlete looking to where to go, is that something that really resonates, that this is a league that you really want to be part of?
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, like Kathy said, night in, night out, we're playing some of the best teams in the country, and it's just so competitive and so much fun.
When you talk about environments out there, it's fun to watch, both live and on BTN, the craziness that happens at these matches. Is that, I mean, talk about that feeling a little bit in each of the gyms.
Yeah, I mean, your home crowd is pretty much your rock. I know we had a lot of success at home, and other schools probably did as well. And, yeah, the atmosphere is just crazy. It's really fun.
In an away game, where was your most favorite place to play?
I like playing at Purdue. They have a great student section, and their whole crowd gets really rowdy, and it's just fun to kind of shut them up in a way, and it's really fun. So. Yeah.
You know, I think it's weird. It's every place has a different feel to it. And so you have to get ready for what it is. You know, like for years, Michigan had this student section that was reaching over the top and yelling at you. And then at Wisconsin, you have that. Illinois has a great student section on the side. So they're so close to the players. And, you know, just Penn State is huge. Their student section on the side, too, which makes difference behind or on the side. Those that does affect you.
Yeah.
But they're such different crowds, but they're so loud and they're so energetic. The attendance in the Big Ten is the number one conference in the country in attendance. We finished this year sixth in attendance, but we were the fourth in the Big Ten. So
listen, when you're talking about when Kathy's out recruiting for the for the future, what in basketball you have guards and you have post players. What are the components that Kathy would be looking for when she's out recruiting? What different styles of play, I guess?
I think a lot of height. There's been a lot of tall girls.
Tall is
that,
good.
Yeah, tall is always good. She likes the raw players, kind of like. Not a lot of experience, but she likes to mold.
Believe me, I like experience. Don't get me wrong. I would take long experience.
Yeah, that's true. She just likes to mold players and take chances. And
Would you see her as a teacher? I mean, there are people who are coaches, who but there are also people who are genuine teachers, both of life and of the game. And really, I'm not sure your definition of raw player, but somebody who really also wants to learn and be a part of it, as opposed to, gee whiz, look at what I did ahead of time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you learn so much about the game and just about life in general, and there's so many lessons that you can take from the game, and Kathy helps a lot with that, and she really cares about us as players and more as people, though, so yeah.
So away from volleyball, some of the things about Michigan State that have been enriching for your life.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is just the family atmosphere and just the size and the name of Michigan State. Like, you can go traveling all around. We go to a lot of airports, and you just see a person with a Spartan hat on and
go green.
Yep. And yeah, it's just so cool.
We also do Spartan Will now, so just
Spartan's Will.
Yeah.
I do love that Spartan's Will. I love it.
I think
for us, you know, just going to some of the things you're talking to Alyssa about, you know, when we recruit, it is really important. I mean, I the family feel here is different than a lot of places, and I think it does separate us from a lot of the Big Ten schools. Players, you know, they stay involved for long, you know, well into their alumni years, way back there. They're coming back and they're giving back. But, you know, there's a camaraderie between programs. There's a camaraderie with the campus. And I think that's real. You know, that's authentic. And I can hear that from other kids when they're coming on campus visits, different recruits. They say this is something that they haven't felt somewhere else. And I like that a lot, because it is what it's about. The relationships that you take with you are going to last a lifetime. The lessons in volleyball, the lessons that you can learn both as a player. And I guess when Alyssa said raw, she was kind of a raw player from Holland Christian. Mm-hmm. And you know, she was this amazing talent. She didn't even know what she could do. She was very athletic, but she hadn't had a lot of volleyball training. And I'll take a chance on a kid like that. But I'll take a chance on them if they have great character, if they're willing to work hard and process, and they're moving towards being the best they can be. I knew she came from a great family. I knew that she would work. I knew that she aspired to be great. You know, if she didn't want those things, I wouldn't take a raw player in Alyssa. But see, she had some intangibles, because she's amazingly athletic, and she's very quick, and she's one of the most physical athletes in the country. Therefore, she got the second team All-American. She was a little bit more rough in her freshman, sophomore year. She's really gained a lot, and that's really...
Including your serve.
Yeah, including her serve, yeah. So, yes, we've had some moments, haven't we? Yeah. But, but as they grow, they get so, and she will be a candidate for the national team. She's going to try out with the national team programs this in about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And along with six players that were invited from our U.S. Olympic coach, invited six players out to Colorado Springs.
That's
to try out for the
number.
Team. Mm-hmm. It's a large number, and it's because we do have a lot of talent. All at different levels of where they're at, but as they grow, you know, you want to be able to get that. So what I've done in recruiting too is, like, you might take a step down with character, you know, just you might be missing a little experience, but if we have a teaching program, they can catch up,
right.
And by the time they get a little older, you start to see it mesh through. Sure, I'd love to have the athleticism, the skill, and the all experiences, but that's hard. There's only so many people that are out there that can play at that level coming out of high school. So if I'm going to pick something, I'm gonna look at teaching a little bit more.
But with high character.
With high character, because without care, you know what? You don't work hard. You don't want to learn. You don't want to do the things you need to do. You're not going to get there.
What have you seen? You know, you've been a coach for a while. You've played volleyball, you know, for a long time. Mm-hmm. What's been the biggest difference in the game today than it was a while ago? And what do you see for the future?
the physicality in this league is ridiculously high. We play more like men, you know, than, and the size in the Big Ten is there. So you're seeing the speed of the ball. It's traveling at a much higher pace. You're seeing the person-to-person ability grow. So the balance of the offense, which means you have to cover more space, which there's gaps, and the offense is, just keeps gaining, like, layers. So offensively, different layers come at you, and defensively you have to be ready to play that. So you've got to be – you've got to be so fast, hand-eye. You've got to be stopped. You can't be leaning. Everything is coming at you quickly. And then you have to redirect this thing. So it's like if I'm playing baseball and I'm trying to hit it in right field and it's coming at me, you know, 90 miles an hour, how do you do that? So they're taking
What's the speed of a volleyball for
probably about 60 miles an hour, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I say that because it gives a calibration for people who have watched sports in various of ways. Because on TV, it doesn't look that fast.
Right, it's fast. Yeah. And it's coming at you, and you're 10 to, you know, 30 feet away, you know.
So the response time is greater.
Yeah.
Is actually faster than a baseball player at 90 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. It's
I get
fast.
My physics correct.
And then you have to take a great job. But then you have to take this platform, and you have to angle it to the next person. So you're trying to deliver it to the setter off that hot hit. So you're trying to get it redirected, and it's just, it takes an amazing athlete to do that. And, you know, when we're talking to our hitters, we're talking about throwing everything you have into the ball. So having your momentum coming through, your core is really snapping through. So it's not all the pressure on the shoulder, but that you can throw everything in because the reaction time for the...
So how do you use techniques to because there are brain development techniques that are now available to deal with the speed coordination question, which is different than... How I have my hands. Okay.
Right, right, right,
I can do how I have my hands, but I can't do the seeing and the brain development. So how has that changed, and how are you thinking about getting people more schooled in those fashion in the future, given
brain science? There are some people that are coming up with some eye training, and we have these kind of glasses that like come and cut off your light so you can't see, and so we're trying to get them to track better. However, we don't use them near as much as we probably need to. But the game is about seeing. What is everybody doing? And without looking directly at something, can I see everything happening and put it in a sequence that makes sense? The fastest, the second fastest, and third. So how do we sequence what's happening and what decisions do you have to make? And that's read blocking for Garve. She's going to have to get there and be able to see all the stuff coming at her and then make a quick move without, like, getting off balance. You can't be taken like a fish on a hook. You want to make sure you're balanced. And then you're blasting off and seeing, but you got to make sure that you're seeing it. And I know there's new techniques that they're using. They're really studying it so that they can help all of us do that, you know, games and video games and things like that. But that I know they're starting in football. So, you know, Garve has come a long way with reading because at the beginning you had no idea. She was playing in small volleyball. And then all of a sudden, but she's the physicality to do these things and the interest in becoming the best she can be. So
when you get your diploma in hand and eligibility is over, what's the future hold, Alyssa?
Well, I'm hoping to go play pro, whether that be overseas or down in Puerto Rico or anywhere, really.
Is that where the options, like if you want to go pro, what are the options?
Europe is a big place. Yeah, there's not many in the States except for the national team. So, I'm pretty excited. It's just...
And then after volleyball.
After volleyball, I don't really know what I want to do, but
your major is
communications. Mm-hmm. So it's very broad. So that's what I need. But
so I could see you maybe on the sidelines for maybe Olympics in 8, 10, 12 years from now.
Yeah,
right. You'll be one of those sideline reporters.
Are you interested in broadcasting?
Not really. Okay. No, I'm not a big public speaker in general. Yeah. I guess, but I've gotten better. So it's all about growth.
It is
my opinion.
Growth.
So yeah. I've come a long way.
She surely has.
I'd be like shaking in the corner over there about 2 years ago. So the
folks on radio can't determine whether you are or not, but we can. We will attest that you are an extraordinarily polished young woman, and without speaking to your athletic skills, because I've watched you play, but extraordinarily polished young woman who's still. Like all of us growing, but a terrific representation of Michigan State University.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Go green.
Go white.
There you go.
That was Spartans volleyball coach Kathy George and student athlete Alyssa Garvelink
Talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear the conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, the Governor's Michigan Pipeline Safety Advisory Board is awaiting two very important reports related to Enbridge's very controversial pipeline number 5 in the Straits of Mackinac. But a recent Enbridge work plan has raised additional concerns about the pipeline's integrity. With us to discuss these more recent developments is Jennifer McKay. Jennifer is the policy director for the Tip of the Mitt Watershed Council, and she's also a member of the Pipeline Advisory Board. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Jennifer, before we get into line 5, give our listeners a snapshot about the work of Tip of the Mitt Watershed Council.
Tip of the Mitt Watershed Council is a nonprofit located in Petoskey, which is just south of the bridge in the northern Michigan. And we speak for northern Michigan waters. We're dedicated to protecting our lakes, streams, wetlands, and groundwater through a variety of means: respected advocacy, innovative education, technically sound water quality monitoring, thorough research, and on-the-ground restoration activities.
Yeah, I noticed on your website you've been around since 1979, so quite a track record.
Absolutely. We've been around for a while, and we're quite respected, and we do great work both locally here in northern Michigan, but also specifically on a lot of our policy and advocacy efforts, both throughout all of Michigan and the entire Great Lakes Basin.
Well, as policy director, you focus on a number of things: invasive species, hydraulic fracturing. One of those areas you focus on is pipeline policy. Recently, you were quoted in the Detroit Free Press article by Kevin Matheny that focused on whether some of the areas along the pipeline, and we're talking pipeline number 5, are actually losing their anti-corrosive protective coating. Tell us a little bit about that.
So I happen to be on the Enbridge website looking for a completely separate document, and I found a biota investigation work plan that Enbridge had submitted to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as part of the consent decree, which was signed with the Department of Justice and Enbridge for their spill in 2010 in Marshall, Michigan that contaminated the Kalamazoo River. The biota investigation work plan is actually to look at if, in fact, the zebra, quagga mussels, algae that is growing on the pipeline in the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac is having any impact on the integrity of the pipeline. And what I found in the document was quite interesting is that they referred to what are called holidays, which are a term industry uses for areas of the pipeline where there is a loss of coating around the pipe. And so they identified areas along the pipe where these holidays have been identified and that they plan on sampling. So it raised significant concern and a number of questions for me that then, you know, I shared with my fellow advisory board members and others.
Well, you know, the euphemistic term holidays, I had not been familiar with that term, but that kind of raises the hackles a little bit. Kind of an interesting way of referring to a major potential problem.
I had never heard the term holidays. I'm actually not sure where it came from either. I did hear anecdotally that boat makers, when they miss an area with varnish, they call it holiday. So apparently it's a term used in a couple different varieties for missing an area with the coating.
I'm talking with Jennifer McKay, who's the policy director for the Tip of the Mint Watershed Council. She's also a member of the pipeline, the governor's Michigan Pipeline Safety Advisory Board. What is this outer coating actually made of, Jennifer?
So the coating that Enbridge puts forth as one of the most substantial and best coatings is a coal tar enamel. And then it actually has a fiberglass wrap around it. And so one of the questions that comes up is what exactly are they seeing with respect to what's missing or what is potentially damaged? They call it delaminating or dislodged. And how does that impact the integrity of the pipeline, because the entire point of a coating is to prevent corrosion. And obviously, corrosion can cause pipelines to weaken and rupture.
Yeah, so there's a fiberglass coating and there's another coating. So both those coatings would have to be eroded before, I'm trying to follow you, before bare pipe would be exposed. Is that correct?
Correct.
And the holiday areas seem to suggest that both of those coatings would be, or is that something that you're trying to find out?
That is one of the primary questions, is it because the work plan just identifies areas where there's coating loss. So what is not included in the work plan is what is the extent of coating loss? Is it just a little bit? Is it all of the coating? None of that information is included. So that's one of the main questions.
Given the Kalamazoo River situation you mentioned earlier and maybe other studies, are there any studies out there that you've seen that indicate a correlation between the degree of erosion and then subsequent pipeline failure?
There are, but it's with certain types of coating. So, for example, the Kalamazoo River spill was actually caused from an issue where the coating became dislodged and it allowed for a corrosion to occur. But the coating on that pipeline was a different kind of coating than what we have on Line 5. So there are studies with certain types of coating, but I mean, really, the coating we know of for Line 5 hasn't exemplified any sort of serious concerns with respect to breaking down like some of the other coatings.
Okay. I've read some of the quotes from the biota investigation work plan. And although Enbridge said in the newspaper article I referenced that they were talking about some hypothetical scenarios, I mean, reading those quotes, it seems like these holiday areas are de facto. I mean, they refer to them as existing. I don't think there's any other way to read that.
There is no other way to read that. They clearly identified where the holidays are. They marked them on a map. They have a level of specificity that precludes any type of hypothetical. The big question, again, that arises is what is the extent of coating loss and how is that impacting the integrity of the pipeline?
Right. Between now and June, when we expect those two reports that I referenced earlier, one on risk assessment and the other on alternatives to Line 5, I mean, what does your group hope that Enbridge or the state or whatever should do in the meantime, especially given this new information about these holidays?
Well, actually, I contacted the co-chairs of the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board, which is the director of DEQ, Heidi Grether, and the director of the Michigan Agency for Energy, Valerie Brader. And they subsequently have requested from Enbridge to provide a presentation at the next advisory board meeting to discuss these holiday areas that are mentioned. And Enbridge has agreed. So on March 13th, the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board is meeting in Lansing, and hopefully we'll have more of our questions answered regarding, you know, what was found in this work plan.
Well, Jennifer, I was at the last one in Lansing, and on the March 13th, I assume it's going to be at the same place. I need to plan on being there. Is it going to be in the afternoon?
Yes, it's going to be in the same place. It's at the Michigan Agency for Energy building, and it's from 1:30 until 3:30, unless we go over, which is typical these days.
Well, Jennifer, maybe I'll have a chance to meet you at this next meeting, and we're going to follow this as things unfold. And, of course, we're very much looking forward to those two reports. So maybe we'll talk to you down the line.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.
I've been talking with Jennifer McKay. We've been talking about Enbridge Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac. Jennifer is the policy director for the TIP of the Mitt Watershed Council. She's also a member of the Pipeline Advisory Board. Jennifer, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Here's Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis.
We're here today to celebrate. It's a celebration of two great Spartans who have committed themselves to changing the fortunes of this great city of Detroit and are now helping to transform Michigan State University. We're proud to announce today that Dan and Jennifer Gilbert, both graduates of Michigan State University, have made a $15 million gift to support the university. This generous gift will support the basketball programs as part of a new addition and renovation at the Breslin Center. It will also support two programs, the Detroit Scholars Program and the Resource Center for Persons with Disabilities, both of which provide critical support for students who have overcome unique challenges to get to college.
It's an honor to be in a position to be able to contribute and help Michigan State University in any way we can.
That's MSU alumnus Dan Gilbert.
The truth of the matter is, you know, I'm very proud to have gone to Michigan State. Really, really am. I just feel like it's like there's just something about it. I can't even, there's really words don't describe it. It's like a can-do. You just get it done.
Tom Izzo says the gift means a lot to him.
It's not the building that you're going to help us build, but the people in it and what it stands for gives me a reason to gloat a little bit. I'm honored to go out recruiting, and you're in my recruiting speech, I want you to know, and as one of our greatest alums, and because you're an owner, that helps my recruiting. So
Izzo adds that the Gilbert's gift will help Spartans reach their dreams.
I've gotten a chance to live my dream, but I really haven't yet. And he makes me realize I haven't, because when you get done with one big dream, there should be another big dream to try to accomplish. And that's what you've taught me. You have been a role model, as they said, for a lot of Spartans, but a lot of people. And I just want to thank both of you for helping another one of my dreams, you know, the future of Michigan State University, and then small part, Michigan State Athletics. But Michigan State University and what you're doing for it, what you're doing for people that aren't as privileged, aren't as lucky, but they too will get a chance to live their dreams. So my thing to you and Jennifer is thank you from the bottom of my heart for helping me live mine, helping me give a chance to other players to live theirs, but now you've expanded it to other students. And we are going to have, I think, the nicest facility in the country. And my job, make sure I put enough good players in there to help me and us now. Hell, maybe even you later. If I can find another LeBron, you know. So I'm going to try to do both. And thank you so very much for what you've done. I greatly, greatly appreciate it.
President Simon calls the Gilberts perfect examples of citizen scholars who embody the land-grant spirit.
When I think about what it means to be a land-grant scholar, a part of Michigan State in an old tradition, and what that really means and sets us apart. It's people who are extraordinarily talented in their own right. And they want to use that talent not just for themselves in terms of creating a building or a project, but how do you leverage that talent on behalf of others? Because it's leadership, investment of yourself, not just money, in order to transform for others, your community, and people you don't know. And in the gifts that we're announcing today, it does all of those kinds of things. It helps us to keep dreams bigger for folks who are part of our programs and activities, not just to make it, but to make their dreams bigger. And that's the lesson of a land-grant scholar, both Dan and Jennifer.
Mike Hudson leads MSU's Resource Center for Persons with Disabilities and appreciates what the Gilbert's gift will allow his team to do.
You know, disabilities should not, need not preclude the achievement of goals and dreams. Definitely, they're going to mandate some levels of creativity, a lot of commitment, and frankly, a repertoire of compensatory techniques. And the team at the Resource Center for Persons with Disabilities remains a leader, has engaged heavily in trying to let people see that brightest possibility that MSU means for so many people. Disabilities are not stopping people at Michigan State University.
Susie Merchant is MSU's women's basketball coach.
You know, I say to my team and a lot of young people, you're not products of your environment. You're products of the people in your environment. And so when you step foot on Michigan State, there was many things there that probably changed you, and most of them were people. So I truly want to say thank you for what you've invested in Michigan State as a whole. And so to include Michigan State women's basketball in this vision, I just want to say thank you very much from the bottom of my heart.
I think it helps us in leaps and bounds, not just with the facility, but with the statement it says about a family that is giving back to a lot of different places here in Cleveland and Michigan State, and probably a lot more than I don't even know about. So that's what I'm so impressed with.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association with some important news. We've eliminated the dues requirement to make it easier than ever to become part of the Spartan alumni family. To associate with the world's largest organization of MSU alumni, all you have to do is tell us who you are and where you are. Visit msu.edu/connect. And click the Update Your Profile button. Share your contact information and you're in. msu.edu/connect. It's that simple. And here's the story behind the story. We eliminated dues because we want you to be able to support whatever part of the university touches your heart. And we've created a Spartan Loyal alumni group with special recognition for alumni who contribute $100 or more per year to any college or MSU organization. Contribute to the Spartan Fund and you're Spartan Loyal. Contribute to the Marching Band and you're Spartan Loyal. Contribute to your college, a favorite student organization, or a scholarship, and you're Spartan Loyal. In a world where public support of higher education is increasingly at risk, your philanthropic investment in Michigan State University has never been more important. So visit msu.edu/connect to update your information and join the worldwide Spartan family. And for more details on how our elimination of dues can benefit you, visit the MSUAA website at alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association. We're Spartans helping Spartans. Join the movement today.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.